You may be seated. Our third case this morning is 13-1255, 13-1501, State of Ohio versus Frank Rogers, Jr. Is it Mr. Chalupka?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. Madam Chief Justice, my name is Adam Chalupka, and I represent the State of Ohio in State versus Frank Rogers, Jr. I am here today asking you to do two things as a result of the 8th District's en banc in this particular case. The first is to reverse their holding that a trial court must sua sponte make an inquiry into the matter of allied offenses when the offenses on their face possibly may be allied. My argument is based primarily on the plain error that there's no evidence in this particular record that we can find plain error and thus reverse a case for remand and resentencing for this analysis on that issue alone, the facial inquiry. Second, I ask this court to affirm the second certified conflict in this case, where two victims in a receiving stolen property case, so two counts of receiving stolen property with the separate victim in each case, will always not be allied offenses because they are crimes against a person and not the property. I've labeled for the first certified conflict, which is in conflict out of, I believe, the 6th District in State v. Wallace. That pertains to what I've labeled in my brief as the truck and tire case. There, Mr. Rogers pled guilty to a felony of the fourth degree receiving stolen property of a motor vehicle, which was a Ford F-150, and also pled guilty to an F-5 receiving stolen property of tires and rims. That was personal property and therefore felony of the fifth degree. And also possession of criminal tools for the lug nut and wrench. Now, there is nothing in the record of that particular case other than in the indictment it says the tires and wheels and the truck itself were both owned by the same victim. However, he pled guilty to that plea agreement. I should also mention that as a part of this case, the trial court managed to dispose of 8 cases that Mr. Rogers had managed to pick up over the course of 2 years. And in that plea agreement, there was an agreement that he would be doing prison time, but there was not an agreement as to how much, and that would be determined at sentencing. After he pled guilty to the offenses in the truck case, as well as the two counts of receiving stolen property and what I've labeled the multiple victim case, at sentencing, the judge stated that she reviewed the PSI. Victims from the multiple victim case testified along the lines of they know based on confessions from a co-defendant that Mr. Rogers burglarized both of their homes, and that why we couldn't prove that, there was evidence heard on the record in the argument, or mostly the testimony from the victims, that he took things from two separate homes on the same dates, two separate burglaries, and he was eventually, I believe, picked up in Lakewood as he tried to fence the items at a pawn shop. Now, at sentencing, what's very important in this case is no objection was made to allied offenses in either of the truck and tire case or the multiple victim case. That's extremely important because under this court's case law in State v. Komen, if there is not an objection raised, then the defendant waives all but plain error. Now, I would like to take it a step further and say that if you plead guilty to offenses during the plea colloquy has informed a defendant of his maximum potential sentence, therefore, we wouldn't even review under plain error at that level if it wasn't objected to, because he would have waived his right to his statutory protection against allied offenses. He made a knowingly, intelligently, and voluntary plea, knowing full well, as in this case, that he was potentially going to be sentenced to 24 months in the truck and tire case if they were ran consecutively, and also knew that he would be sentenced up to 18 months in the multiple victim case if sentenced consecutively.
So he knew that was going to be the maximum.
He did.
So if the judge engages in an allied offense analysis, you're saying that would preclude the judge from doing that?
The judge is absolutely allowed to have an allied offense analysis. However, I disagree with the 8th District in that the judge cannot, it's not the judge's responsibility to bring up the allied offenses under, no matter how you read Underwood or the allied offense statute or Williams to actually conduct the analysis sua sponte from the bench. It's up to the defendant, and I believe, as quoted as recently as Washington at the end of last year, this court has relied on its holding in Mugeri, I believe was the case, that it is the defendant's responsibility to bring up that issue. Since it is the defendant's responsibility to object and invoke his protection against being sentenced to allied offenses, that he must object or else it's a waiver, first off, because he knew what his maximum sentence would be. And if it isn't a waiver, then he forfeits all but plain error on appeal. And in this particular case, since our record was so sparse, there was nothing in the record for the 8th District to determine that there even was plain error and that the allied offense statute was violated. And under the general rules of appellate practice, and Appellate Rule 12, Appellate Rule 9, and various cases that I cite in my brief from this court, it is the defendant's duty, when claiming an error on appeal, to make his case and point to the record where the error was. Here there was no objection. On top of that, there was no error. There was nothing in the record to show an error for them to find in plain error. And this has been consistently held by this court following State v. Komen in several cases of such as Faust, Elmore, and Yarbrough. And in Yarbrough, as well as Johnson, when there was lots of facts in the record from trials for the reviewing appellate court to make its de novo conclusion that there were allied offenses. Here, we don't have any facts. And since no facts were put on by the defendant, his defense attorney, whose responsibility it was to raise those issues at sentencing, the 8th District cannot find, well, there might be error, or there's a possibility of error. That's not the standard for Criminal Rule 32B. Criminal 32B means there must be error, that it must be plain, and that it affects substantial rights. I will concede that substantial rights are affected when allied offenses are imposed when they shouldn't have been. I will not concede that there was an error here. There was nothing in the record that there was an error here. Furthermore, it wasn't plain, and it needs to be plain. That's the whole basis of criminal, that's why it's called plain error, because it needs to be obvious on the record. Here, it's not obvious on the record that anyone made an error. For all we know, the judge, typically a PSI, will contain little copy and paste from the police report. The judge could have seen more facts than were actually put on the record by either counsel, the prosecution or the defense attorney, and made his decision. And I do not believe that Williams necessarily...
Counsel, are you therefore asking us to speculate or concede what the trial court was thinking or had before them?
I believe that this court needs to take in consideration the facts before the trial court. The de novo review would obviously allow the law to be reanalyzed de novo, but whatever is before
the
record...
Are you calling the PSI a fact?
They can be. In this particular case, it was not made a part of the record, but the judge did see it. And under Washington...
Well, it's irrelevant at that point, is it not, if it's not in the record before us?
For this case, yes, you're right. It's irrelevant because I do not know. I'm pretty sure it wasn't made a part of the appellate record. But in general, anything in the record, and the trial court did see it, that they can take that into account in their allied offense analysis, even at sentencing.
But if we keep your analysis to this case, we can't presume that...
You cannot use it in this case, but going forward...
But we are talking about this case, are we not?
This case, you would not be able to actually use it in this case because it wasn't a part of it. But the judge did see it.
Counsel, with respect to the 8th District's view of Underwood, it sounds like the 8th District suggests that we had said anytime there are multiple offenses, it's the duty of the trial judge to raise the issue of allied offenses.
That's how I take it entirely as to what the 8th District said. I don't think, they also said that we should ignore Komen, but this court does not cite Komen and Underwood. Or
Komen was a 1990
case, which was basically, they raised it for the first time on appeal. He was convicted of 3 counts of aggravated burglary and 4 counts of receiving stolen property. The first time on appeal was when he raised the issue of allied offenses. At that point, this court, I actually believe the district court, which was the 10th district, did review it, and I don't know what their finding was, but this court said that was irrelevant. He didn't object to it at the sentencing, therefore, as per the appellate practice and plain error, then the rule of plain error, it could not be considered. He forfeited that word. I believe they say it waived, but it seems like there might be confusion on sometimes the courts will conflate waived and forfeiture. I would argue, again, the knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily, the waiver, but I would also accept if you find the failure to object to be a forfeit of that right, and then there need to be a record to actually show the plain error. On so, to the second issue of this case is whether or not two victims, and when there's two counts of receiving stolen property that are indicted as if they occurred on the same day, but there are two separate individual victims in each indictment. Because receiving stolen property is termed as an offense per the statutory language against another, this court has been very clear in such cases as State v. Jones, as long as I think the Seventh District really outlines it a lot in Tapiscott, all of these are cited in my brief, that as it is an offense, receiving stolen property is actually an offense of another, the person who's actually been grieved because his property at some point or another was stolen, that we have separate victims, and the separate victims bring us our dissimilar import, they bring us our separate animus. And as a result of that, a defendant should be sentenced to each one of those crimes so that all the victims are properly aggrieved at the sentencing process.
And that's what the Eighth District said.
That is what the Eighth District said.
And that's what you want us to affirm.
I would love for you to affirm that part.
And that's
of the
Wallace case.
Yes.
And the Rogers case is the truck and tires case.
Well, both of them are Frank Rogers.
All
these
right.
are two multiple cases that were disposed of at the same time.
Okay.
The Wallace case is the Ninth District that held
okay,
that,
that's the
certified conflict,
conflict case. Okay. Go ahead.
So again, I would like for you to reverse this idea of the trial court sua sponte looking into a facial, on a facial possibility of allied offenses, making an inquiry into that issue without any the prosecution or the defense talking about its sentencing.
Well, I thought that the Court of Appeals said in its opinion that it was unable to determine whether the tires and the rims came from the same vehicle or another vehicle.
Yes, and that's what they said. But the first time around in Rogers 1, they said that meant there wasn't a record of the evidence, and so they couldn't look at it under plain error. But the second time around, they said—
You don't want us to deal with the factual finding, do you?
No, because we're not at that point yet. We're still just on the issue of whether or not the 8th District correctly got the law right
well,
to reverse
the 8th
and
District said because of that, there was no inquiry by the court, and that is plain error, if I understand what the opinion said.
Yeah, and my—
What do you want us to do with that finding of the 8th District?
That in order to actually properly apply a plain error under Criminal Rule 52B, there must be a record before the reviewing court. Here, we didn't have anything of a record other than the indictment.
Well, and that's what the court said. It said, on its face, there's a facial possibility that could trigger, that should trigger the trial court's inquiry on merger. That's what they're basically saying. Forget the facts, because we don't have those in the record, but if you just look on the face of the the convictions or the face of the crimes here, if there's the possibility that there is a merger issue, it is incumbent upon the judge to inquire.
Yes, and...
And you say without more than just the crimes themselves, bare-bones description of the crimes, without more, it's not incumbent upon the judge
yes,
to do that.
Because this idea of a facial inquiry... We don't know what that means. We don't know. It essentially could result in every case that we charge, and then the 8th District reviews, whatever the crimes are. Well, that could be allied offenses. Maybe that's allied offenses. So we're going to reverse and remand.
Well, there's other facts that you have to take into consideration. Was it, you know, the same course of conduct? Was it the same victim? Was it at the same time? I mean, there's more to it than just the bare bones of the, the description in the indictment.
Yes, but when the defendant pleads to the bare-bones indictment, they're admitting all the facts as we present them.
Pardon me?
The defendant is admitting to all the facts that are laid out in the indictment. So we're charging two separate crimes because there were two separate crimes. And that goes back to my waiver analysis, that he knows that he is agreeing to this and that he is going to plead guilty to two separate and distinct crimes. Again,
And the argument is that even if you lay it all out, there still is a double jeopardy issue, right? Even if you are you saying that you can waive double jeopardy?
Yes, it's like any constitutional right, it can be waived. And I know this court had not go that far in Underwood. I know there was a dissent as to that in Underwood. And I believe the dissent, which was by former Justice Cupp, would be how those issues should be interpreted. I'm not saying that's the only way the court can go. The court can go with the forfeiture by failing to raise the objection. But if there is a double jeopardy issue, it would involve things outside the record. And the defendant would then have recourse by filing a petition for post-conviction relief of the ineffective assistance of his counsel. He can bring in the police reports that weren't shown to actually make that argument.
So do you want this remanded to the trial court? Is that what you're seeking?
I want to affirm the original sentences in the truck and tire case.
And that's because the determination by the 8th District Court of Appeals that the failure of the trial court to inquire is plain error is, in your view, an incorrect statement of law.
Yes, because there was no record for them to actually find plain error.
All right.
I see my time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Sweeney.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court. My name is Colin Sweeney. I represent the appellee and cross-appellant Frank Rogers. I'm not entirely sure if he reserved time for rebuttal, but if he did, since I'm a cross-appellant, I would reserve 2 minutes. In this case, I want to be clear. What we're talking about is the multiple count statute 2941.25, and this court has dealt with this statute many times. What it does is it sets out a roadmap for trial courts as to, in multiple count cases, as to when separate sentences and separate convictions is appropriate and when it's not. And subsection A tells us when it's not appropriate, when the same conduct can be construed as more than one offense. Now, when that's the starting point. But there is there are three exceptions to that, and those exceptions are if the offenses are of dissimilar import, if they were committed separately, or if there was a separate animus.
Counsel, I've got a question, though, as to the role of the parties at the trial court.
Sure.
What significance should we be placing on the fact that trial counsel failed to raise the merger question?
Well, the significance is that the standard of review is plain error, and I don't disagree with that. But what I would say is that the error is plain in this case. And the reason for that is all the 8th District did, and to answer Justice Lanzinger's question, they didn't say that Underwood says in every single case a trial court must independently conduct an inquiry. What they said is basically when you meet the first step of the Johnson test, and when you meet subsection A of 2941.25, that two offenses, it is possible that these two offenses were committed with the same conduct. Now, this isn't going to mean the trial court has to do it all the time. If the offenses are alleged to have occurred on different dates, if the offenses are of dissimilar import, or clearly a separate animus, you're not going to have to do that. But when you meet the first step of the Johnson test, and you meet 2941.25 subsection A, the trial court judge at that point in time only has the power to impose a single sentence. If the trial court wants to go beyond that under subsection B and impose multiple sentences, there must be something in the record to show either their offenses of dissimilar import, they were committed separately, or with separate animus.
But the record here, especially from the Court of Appeals, says it's unclear if they're from the same stolen pickup truck. We don't know. There's no facts before us.
What I would say is,
so the appellate court sort of assumed plain error and put a duty on the trial court. And that's not in the statute.
I guess I wouldn't agree with that reading of the decision. What the Court of Appeals did is they looked at the record. Everything that is in the record, and I would agree that it wasn't a trial, it wasn't fully developed, but what we do know, let's take each case. The truck and tires case, for instance. We know the offenses occurred at the same location, the same date, and involved the property belonging to the same person. Based on that record, you can look at that and say there is absolutely no evidence that these offenses were committed separately or anything other than with the same conduct. You take the jewelry case, for instance, which is even more clear, and I know there's a question about the multiple victims. But in this case, the prosecutor got up and said that the jewelry was disposed of. The reason he was charged with these two offenses, it was disposed of in a single transaction. Again, the jewelry, the defendant was accused of receiving that stolen property in the same date, and there's never been a suggestion it was a different transaction. And so there is an adequate record here to determine that first step of the Johnson test, and that is that it is possible these offenses were committed with the same conduct. Now, the state has an opportunity, or the trial court has an opportunity, to go beyond that
well,
and say—
Well, counsel, weren't the victims there to testify?
They gave statements at sentencing.
Okay. Yes. And they're clearly establishing that the jewelry belonged to them in their—
No question. The jewelry belonged to two different people. We don't—
Two different people, two different residences— Okay, and you don't think that that's sufficient for the court to come to the conclusion that there's no merger issue here?
I don't. If he was charged with burglary, if he was charged with theft, I would totally agree with you. If you steal from two different people, no question.
I understand that.
If you receive stolen property in a single transaction that happens to belong to one, five, ten,
but there was no evidence as to that.
The evidence as to how he received the property is that it was received at the same location on the same date. And I would submit that that's an adequate record to demonstrate it was a single transaction. There were these two burglaries. He wasn't charged with that. And I would emphasize that the prosecutor says, we don't have evidence that he took this. All they have evidence of, what they charged him with was disposing of the property at the pawn shop on one occasion. Two persons' property. And what I would say is that the statute is directed towards, it's a property offense. It's not like murder or robbery or theft where you're committing it against this individual people, where a separate animus is clear. If I steal something from all seven of you, clearly I've committed seven offenses. If someone else steals something from all seven of you, gives it to another person, and then he sells it to me, and I buy it knowing it's stolen property, that's a single offense. And in fact, it would be nonsensical if it were otherwise, because then you'd have a situation where somebody buys $7,000 worth of stolen jewelry that belongs to a single person. That's one F5. But it happened to belong to seven different people. That person had no idea, and so now we have seven F5s. That's not what the General Assembly intended. And actually, there's even more than just the general multiple counts statute. There's a more specific statute on point that makes it even clearer that the General Assembly did not intend that. And that is the statute with respect to valuation, 2913.61. If more than one item of property is involved in a theft offense, the value of the property is determined by an aggregation of that value. Now, the state seems to suggest in its brief, well, look, we can pick and choose. We can aggregate it or we can't aggregate it, depending on which can result in a more serious charge. But the statute is clear. It's not discretionary. It doesn't say it may be aggregated. It says it is aggregated. So here we have jewelry that was retained by Mr. Rogers that did happen to belong to two people, but the value would be aggregated. And so in addition to the fact that there's no separate animus and no separate conduct here, clearly this is a single offense under the aggregation statute. Again, I would like to go back to what this court said in Underwood. And I think what's significant is I think this case, the Eighth District reasonably applied Underwood and Johnson together to make a very common sense rule of law. And that is that when you have a situation where the first step of the Johnson test is met, and that is subsection A of the multi-count statute, then the trial court judge, all they can do is impose a single sentence. So at that point in time, unless something more happens, that first section of the multi-count statute is a restraint on the sentencing authority of the court. Once that first step happens, the judge has to do more to impose multiple sentences. And it's not unlike consecutive sentences. The General Assembly has enacted restraint on the trial court to say, look, you can't impose consecutive sentences unless certain findings are made. Here, somewhat similarly, although more significantly, since this embodies the Double Jeopardy Clause's protections, the General Assembly has said these are multiple punishments. If it's possible that they're committed with the same conduct, you can only impose one sentence. Unless you go to subsection B and you find either that's committed separately, separate animus, or offenses of dissimilar import. I would suggest that actually the 8th District was in some senses generous to the state because they gave them another opportunity to go back to the trial court to make their case that these were committed separately or had a separate animus. In fact, the record in this case, all it shows is that these offenses were committed the same date, time, and even the few statements made by the prosecutor support the idea that this was the same conduct. Clearly, the first step of the Johnson test was met. So that means that the restraint that is set forth in subsection A operates on the judge, and nothing more can be done without these additional findings. I do want to address briefly the state's argument about waiver, which this court addressed, I think, quite clearly in Underwood. And I would also note a significant difference in Underwood. That was an agreed sentence where the person said, look, I'm agreeing to this particular outcome. But even in that context, this court made clear that you don't, by entering a plea, that doesn't waive the trial court's mandatory duty to merge allied offenses at sentencing. The allied or multiple count statute says you can be charged and found guilty of allied offenses. So when you plead guilty, that's perfectly appropriate. You can plead guilty to allied offenses. But when you get to sentencing, the judge can only impose a conviction on one. So there's no error, there's no defect at the time of the plea to even raise at that point in time. The issue comes about at the time of sentencing. So waiver is clearly inapplicable for that reason, but also because we're talking about a constitutional right. And in Underwood, this court was very clear that you can't infer a waiver from silence. So what the 8th District said is that the error here was that there was the first step of the Johnson test was met, that there was it was possible that these offenses were committed with the same conduct. The first subsection A of the multi-count statute was met, and therefore it was incumbent upon the trial court judge, that restraint has arisen that the General Assembly imposed. It's incumbent upon the trial court judge to do more if it wants to impose separate sentences or separate convictions. And because that didn't happen, and I would submit that based on the record we have, it's unlikely to happen when they come back because these offenses were committed at the same time and involved property, tires on a truck. In fact, the prosecutor says that the tires had been taken off the truck, but they clearly were from that truck. So, I mean, it would be unlikely if somebody steals a truck and then happens to break it down into 10 constituent parts, you wouldn't charge the person with 10 theft offenses. It's even more clear in the context of receiving stolen property that this is a single offense. So the last thing I would note is with respect to Komen and its significance, and that is that, first of all, it uses waiver incorrectly. It really means forfeiture, and I think this court has gotten more precise on that terminology. But the other thing is that one of the reasons that Komen is didn't require any further inquiry is because these were offenses of dissimilar import. They were aggravated burglary and receiving stolen property. And this court has been clear, and the General Assembly has been clear in its multi-count statute and the commentary on it, that burglary does not merge with an offense committed inside the home. Those are offenses of dissimilar import, so Komen is really inapplicable. So what is applicable is the combination of Underwood and Johnson, which make clear that the General Assembly has set forth a roadmap for imposing sentences in multi-count cases.
Has any other case put a duty on the trial court to make the initial inquiry where the defendant has not raised the issue?
You mean Supreme Court case?
Yes.
No, the answer to that's no. And I guess what I would say to that is the point is that when the record establishes that there is the first step of the Johnson test is met, then the trial court has no, it's not that they have a duty to do more, it's that they have a duty to do more if they want to impose multiple sentences. What the record that was provided to the trial court showed was that you have enough here to impose a single sentence based on Johnson's first step.
What do you make of the argument that he was advised of the maximum sentence consecutive on each of the counts so that he knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily entered his plea?
Well, nobody's questioning that it was the plea was knowing. But the point is that when you advise someone at the plea of the potential penalties. It's not like you go into an inquiry as to what might be allied or what might not be allied. The truth is that is what he was potentially facing. But when you get to the point of sentencing, that's when you make the allied offense determination. And in this case, the determination should have been that these offenses were allied. So we're not arguing his plea was invalid, but what we're saying is that the trial court could not impose separate sentences when you have a record that indicates only that at most that these were committed, that these offenses could have been committed with the same conduct and therefore met the first step of the Johnson test. And I would just note that this rule is not only dictated, I think, by this court's precedent and the statute, it's good sense. It's actually what most trial court judges already do. And the reason for that is because it gets these issues resolved at the beginning, and it ensures that the sentences that are imposed are sentences intended by the General Assembly and authorized by the Double Jeopardy Clause.
But isn't the best practice that the defense counsel will raise the issue with the trial court? I mean, because in a situation like this, there's more than one crime that's been pled to. So the usual thought from the point of view of the judge is the sentencing's on the offenses to which there has been a plea entered. And since allied offense case law is helpful to the defendant, it should be the defendant's obligation to raise the issue with a trial judge that, Your Honor, in this case, an allied offense analysis may be required.
I don't disagree with that. There's unquestionably best practice, and had that happened, we wouldn't be here today, obviously. I think that the defense counsel should do that, but still, there's an appellate review for plain error, and when the record establishes, despite defense counsel's failure to raise the issue, that the first step of the Johnson test is met such that it is possible that these offenses were committed with the same conduct, then the trial court can only impose a single sentence, whether or not it was raised by defense counsel. It's somewhat similar to the consecutive sentencing circumstance. It would be best practice for defense counsel to say, hey, you got to make these findings if you're going to impose consecutive sentences. But still, we've required the trial courts to do that. It would also be best practices to point out if the judge is giving 18 months on a felony of the fifth degree, but when this comes up on appeal and it's a sentence that's not authorized by law, it would still be reversed. So the point isn't to slough off more on the trial court judge, but we can't escape the fact that the General Assembly has set forth a procedure that must be followed in order to impose multiple counts. And if that procedure is not followed and there's not one of these findings in B, that these offenses are of a dissimilar import, separate conduct, or committed separately, and the record does not otherwise establish that, then the trial court is limited to a single sentence. And it was appropriate to reverse for that reason.
Although the statute does not use the term shall or shall not, the 2941.25, where we're talking about consecutive sentences, we have a duty on the court that says shall. Here you're saying that the case law as you interpret it is putting that duty on the court, but it's not within the statute.
Well, I guess what I would say is, you know, it's true that the statute doesn't point to a particular party or the trial court, but what it does say is only one sentence can be imposed. Mm-hmm. It's the trial court that's imposing the sentence. If you're a multi-count case, if you fall under subsection A, the trial court can only impose one sentence. If you fall under subsection B, the trial court can impose multiple sentences. And what I'm saying is in this case, on this record, we're a subsection A case. There was nothing that allowed the trial court to impose multiple sentences. No evidence offered or suggested or argued or evident in the record that these offenses were committed separately with separate conduct or were dissimilar import. So wherever you want to shoulder the burden, at some level, all the participants in this process have an obligation to get it right. The state has that obligation. If they want multiple convictions, they need to seek them. The defendant has an obligation to avoid multiple convictions where not appropriate, and then the trial court has an obligation to impose a lawful sentence. And so in this case, all three parties failed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, you may take 30 seconds.
Very, very
Very briefly, Your Honor, I would like to clarify that at no point in my brief nor in oral argument did I say that these tires and rims were from that truck. Whatever was deduced from the discovery given over to the original trial attorney, they had seen police reports. They had made a presumably made a determination that they were not going to object to allied offenses based on what they had seen in discovery. And that, I believe, we get to the point of we can go on post-conviction if we really want to challenge that, because the facts of the actual crime were not on the record.
Well, they weren't on the record, so the judge didn't have it in front of them either.
No. The only way, like I said before, could have been the PSI, but we don't know.
Okay. Thank you. But
thank you very much.
Counsel, you've used your time. You may take 30 seconds.
Your Honor, I have nothing further unless you have questions.
No. Thank you. All right, gentlemen, we'll take that matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decisions. Thank you.